Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop on Washington, where we bring you all the news from the nation's capital and around the world that the government does not want you to know, that the mainstream media is not reporting. Today, I want to talk about some countries, well, you may not have heard of them, but that's even a stronger reason, if you haven't, to go out and learn about these countries. They are countries in Central Asia. All of them are former Soviet republics. All of them have Islam as their primary religion, and all of them, with the possible exception of one, are functioning dictatorships where there's no freedom of the press and where people are treated pretty miserably. And yet, they've all, to some extent, larger or smaller, have oil. I'm talking about the countries ending in the word, in the letters S-T-A-N. The word stan is a Persian word meaning land, and you've probably heard of Afghanistan and Pakistan. But how much do you know about Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan? You know, before the 1990s, before the Persian Gulf War, very few of Americans could have placed Iraq on a map. Before we were attacked on 9/11, few Americans could tell you where Afghanistan was. Oh, they could tell you it was sort of vaguely off in Central Asia somewhere. But we've had to learn a lot about these countries very quickly. And now, of course, we have more than 1,000 American servicemen who've died, servicemen and women, who have died there. Tens of thousands of wounded, even greater civilians killed. And these are important countries. And they're important for various reasons. Some say it's all about Islamic terrorism. Others say it's about oil. Others say it's about the fight for freedom and democracy. But whatever it is, whatever rationale the administration gives, whatever rationale you believe that we are in Iraq, for example, these same rationales apply to these other five countries, which you probably don't know too much about. Now, I don't want to insult your intelligence. Many of you may have been studied over the map, and you know exactly where Tajikistan is. But I suspect it's very few. You kind of have to be someone like me who likes to stare at maps. And I, for one, admit that I don't know much about these countries. So I've invited as my guest someone who does. His name is Chad Clay, and he is an international development business consultant for the USAID Enterprise Development Project for Central Asia. Now, that's a mouthful. What is it? Well, the United States Agency for International Development goes into developing countries and tries to help them. Now, are we helping? Are we hurting? How are we helping these countries economically? Are we doing it just to get U.S. military bases? Are we doing it just to get oil? Are these countries helping us against Islamic terrorism? Or are they helping to foment Islamic terrorism? There are a lot of tough questions, but Chad Clay is just the guy to answer those questions. He is a graduate of Notre Dame. He has an MBA from the University of Virginia. He's a former officer of the Navy. And I want to encourage you to call in. I actually don't expect many calls, I have to say, because I realize this is an area of the world that, well, it's not too often in the media. But that shouldn't stop you from calling in, asking questions, expressing your opinion. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. You can comment on the blog at www.radioinsidescoop.com. Let me introduce our guest, Chad Clay. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. Thanks, Mark.
Well, let me start here with sort of a general history of all of these countries, and then I want to get to each one specifically. Can you tell us, first of all, where they're located on a map for anyone that's actually got an atlas in front of them? Where can they find these countries?
All right. The easiest thing to do is probably find the Caspian Sea, which is on the western border of Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. If you locate the Caspian Sea, you've basically found Kazakhstan. There are five countries that border the Caspian Sea, but Kazakhstan's got a significant part of the shoreline there.
So basically,
so south of Russia and basically to the direct east of the Caspian Sea.
It's kind of south of Russia, west of China, north of Afghanistan, Iran.
Yep.
It's sort of in that middle mountainous area. Now, these are all landlocked countries, right?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Now, if you could, just they have a bit of a common history up until the breakup of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. Can you share with us a little bit about that history?
Well, it actually varies.
Okay.
Despite being lumped together in the kind of the Central Asian group, the countries and the people are very different from one another. And some of the borders, as you may guess, that the Soviet Union drew kind of clumped very different people together and in many cases separated, people of similar heritage. So.
But these were tribes, basically, prior to the Soviet Union?
In some cases, yes. The Kazakhs were made up of three main tribes, but the Uzbeks have a civilization that goes way back. They were not nomadic people, whereas many of the other, the Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz specifically, were actually nomadic. So there's a very rich civilization history found in parts of Uzbekistan, but the history is much more blurred when you're talking about Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, because they were nomadic and they didn't really have a written history. So that's very debated.
I assume they became Islamic back at the time of Muhammad's invasions in the 7th, 8th century?
Yeah, I mean, there's no time when they became Islamic, because it sort of ebbed and flowed, as you may guess. But, it was about that time when it sort of came into existence. And then with the Soviet Union, obviously, that was pretty much squelched. So they're Islamic states, but they're not in the sense that we think of a lot of Middle Eastern states.
Were they more or less free and independent before the Soviet Union took them over? And when did the Soviet Union take them over?
Well, it varies again. More in the 1800s is a period of time called or referred to as the Great Game, when the British and the Russians were sort of vying for power in that part of the world, and the Russian armies came down and slowly, piece by piece, sort of annexed that part of what became the Soviet Empire.
Okay, now under Soviet rule, I assume just as Christianity and Judaism and even Russian Orthodoxy was squelched as much as possible by the communist governments, that they also tried to squelch Islam, being that the Soviet Union was an atheist country. I assume that they tried to squelch that out too?
Exactly, yeah. And what you have as a result is people that, you know, have a Muslim heritage, and they know that they are, you know, they declare that they are part of that religion, but you know, they're learning about it again, because they for a long time, you know, weren't allowed to. So they are Islamic states, but they're kind of learning about what the religion means and what it means to them, and for different people there it means very different things.
Now, under Soviet occupation, obviously the Poles, the Czechs, Germans, Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians very much chafed under that. They didn't have enough power to overthrow the Soviet Union, but they certainly did not like that. Is that fair to say of these Central Asian countries as well?
It's mixed. I mean, in a lot of ways, some people give a lot of credit to the Soviet Union for educating them, bringing in technology, giving them sort of civilization. Again, the Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz were largely nomadic, and they were, you know, in Stalin's time especially, kind of forced to settle down under the virgin land.
So perhaps there wasn't as much people, activists in Central Asia as there was in Eastern Europe against
the Soviet Union. Probably not at that time, yeah. And certainly there are mixed feelings about the Soviet Union. And some people long for the days when they had, a lot of things paid for.
Are they poorer? Are they poorer now than they were under Soviet days?
It depends on which country you're talking about.
But
the Kazakhs are probably better off by and large. And then as you go further south to Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan, in a lot of ways they're worse off economically. So it depends on what area you're focusing on.
Okay, now in the early 1990s, when the Soviet Union broke apart, I assume that came as a bit of a surprise to many of these countries.
Yeah, it was basically the independence that none of them were really demanding. And, you know, Kazakhstan is an example of a country that really never had independence in its existence. It was mainly tribal in a lot of ways. And so you've got a nationalistic feeling now, but, you know, a lot of people don't really know what that means. And they're sort of, it's an interesting to observe the feelings about being Kazakh. What does that mean? So it's interesting.
Now, each country basically took their leader, their Soviet leader, their communist Soviet leader, put in prior to the early 1990s. And I was doing a little bit of history, though you are the expert, Chad. But basically, each of these people ruled as sort of the president for life. There might be fixed elections here or there. But each one of them, until the very recent example of Kyrgyzstan, basically wanted to keep control of – they went from, I guess, a governor of a state to being a leader of a nation.
Yeah, every state except Tajikistan, which actually was in a – they had a civil war prior to the breakup. From about 92 to about 97, but Ramanov, who's the president of Tajikistan, didn't come into power till 94, but in each other case, yeah, they were essentially the Soviet leader, and then they just, you know, became president upon the collapse.
And I do want to get to each individual country, and I promise to do that in this hour. I'm trying, I guess, initially just to sort of get an overview of what these countries have in common, but obviously where they're different, Chad, you got to point that out.
Yep.
They all have pretty significant oil gas deposits. Is that fair to say?
No. Kazakhstan really is in the lead regarding that. Gas and oil also exist largely in Turkmenistan, but the other countries are pretty much without oil and gas. So you've got some economic disparity, certainly, that comes from that. So your oil leaders are Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, but by and large, it's Kazakhstan.
And I want to go through each of these countries. I want to explore their democratic systems, or lack thereof. It's generally the latter. I want to talk about oil reserves, U.S. bases, their role in either promoting Islamic terrorism or fighting Islamic terrorism, and, well, what the U.S. can imagine is in store for these countries. But first, I do have a caller on the line. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine and Chad Clay. Caller, are you there? I think that caller hung up. Maybe they were just listening in but didn't want to pose a question. So let's get right to it. The largest country by far is Kazakhstan. I think it's probably, what, twice, three times, four times as big as the rest put together? Something like that. Chad?
Landmass, which is kind of surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah, I guess about a third the size of the continental United States or so.
Roughly, yeah.
And interestingly, it's not the largest in population, which I discovered in my little bit of research I did. Uzbekistan is. But
uh-huh.
But talking about Kazakhstan, this is, I guess, in many ways a typical country. The leader has been a leader since Soviet times. Talk about the democracy or lack thereof in Kazakhstan.
Well, you've got a situation constitutionally that gives, in each of these states, but a lot of power to the executive branch. So the president really does yield sort of supreme power. He appoints a significant number of each of the legislative houses, so he's got some power there. Those positions are elected outside of the ones that he appoints, but all of the other local governments, there's 14 what are called oblasts that are sort of like states that make up Kazakhstan, and each of the governors of those oblasts is appointed and not elected.
So is it fair to say that the president, Nazarbayev, is a dictator?
You could say that.
Okay.
I mean, he's not going away anytime soon, and any elections that happen, he's going to win in the near future.
Until he
decides to step down, he will be in charge.
There isn't a significant other party that can take over.
There are, but anytime they mount any sort of significant political threat, they're broken up. Or someone is beaten up or put in jail or something.
And Kazakhstan, I believe you said, has the largest oil deposits. Is that right?
Yes.
So it's a very rich country. It's actually, as much as it's a huge country, there's only about 15 million people in the whole country, which is, again, the size of a third of the United States. Compare it to us, a third of our country would be about 100 million people. So it's much, much smaller. What is the United States' role in Kazakhstan? Do we have bases there?
We don't have any military bases. We do have quite a bit of, we're involved a lot in the oil exploration and the, any major U.S. oil company that you can probably think of has probably got some presence there, the largest being Chevron.
So we're getting oil right now from Kazakhstan, from this dictatorship?
They are exporting now, and I'm not sure I think the pipeline is to the point. It was basically near completion or has been completed. But, yeah, I think we are probably receiving oil from it.
Now, are they? Is this a country where we might find significant Islamic terrorism, or to the contrary, a country where you might find the government fighting against Islamic terrorism, or both?
Well, it's not very present, to be honest. And, I lived there for 2.5 years. It was very safe. There really isn't an underground Islamic force there trying to grab hold of the government. And we say dictatorship, but this guy Nazarbayev is certainly probably stolen money. He's got a lot of money in Swiss bank accounts. He lives very lavishly. But the country, by and large, is doing well, and the population is by and large doing very well, and it's not a bad place to live. It really isn't. So,
it's more a stable dictatorship, if you will.
It's stable, and it's not really the ruthless, iron-fisted rule that you may see in other parts of the world, or even other parts of Central Asia.
Are they doing anything to help the United States in fighting al-Qaeda? Do we need their help? Are they important in the war against terrorism anyway?
Yeah, I think they're important. I think the southern countries are more important because they're more sort of on the front line. But they are sort of allies in the fight against terrorism, if you will. They do have troops in Iraq, very few, but they have sent them over. So they're actively participating. They're helping out the United States when it's important to them. They're certainly not pushed around by anyone. The Russians yield a lot of power still in that part of the world.
Now,
and the Chinese are very important too. So you've got a country that's important to a lot of very important people on the political, the international scene.
Now, is USAID doing something to help promote democracy in Kazakhstan, or is that kind of a lost cause?
No, that we're, basically, when you look at what happened in the Ukraine, that sort of was an eye-opening experience to a lot of the leaders in Central Asia. I think that was more eye-opening than what happened in Georgia previously. And
what's the difference, just for our listeners?
The difference between what?
Between Ukraine and Georgia. Why was Ukraine more eye-opening than Georgia?
I think they kind of saw that one coming a little bit, and I think the massive turnouts and the way it was done peacefully and really through the political system in Ukraine, despite some heavy-handedness by the previous leader and the attempts to rig the elections, the fact that was overcome by a generally peaceful process, I think, was sort of eye-opening.
Now, when you say eye-opening, Chad, obviously you can take two lessons from that if you're a dictator. One is, I've got to give some freedoms to my people, or they'll overthrow me. And the other is, no, I can't have free elections, because if I do, they'll overthrow me and I have to crack down harder. What lessons are they learning?
I think both. I think initially they were surprised and certainly maybe initially thought, what do I do about this? A lot of the leaders there, and Nazarbayev, for example, was I heard that he had met with the outgoing president in the Ukraine and basically was sort of told, be very wary of USAID, be very wary of the Soros Foundation, which is a big international donor, specifically in the area of education, be very wary of the Soros Foundation, get them out of your country. So they were frightened, and there was some immediate backlash, both towards some of the U.S. projects operating there. We began to feel a little bit of pressure from the government, the city governments where we had offices, and that was the immediate backlash. But I think long term, I think it probably helped in the way that, you know, the leaders of the country are probably thinking, you know, it's going to happen. There's going to be a move towards democracy, and it can either be gradual and under our control, or it can be sort of a powder keg. And if we clamp down too much, that could certainly be the result. And then, you know, shortly after that, we have the small revolution in Kyrgyzstan, and then we have what's going on in Uzbekistan right now, which could get very ugly.
And, Chad, I want to get to both of those. We have to take a commercial break. When we come back, I want to find out exactly what USAID is doing, what the Soros Foundation are doing, and what's going on in the other four countries of Central Asia. If you want to call in, all you have to do is pick up the phone and dial 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after these messages.
For Anna Briggs, now 94 years young, the ethical treatment of animals has been her life's work. Anna Briggs feels that each dog at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center in Charlestown, West Virginia, from scruffy mutt to sleek purebred, deserves a loving home. All have been spayed or neutered and current with their shots and vaccinations. Plus, the majority of dogs have completed basic obedience training. You can find photos and bios of the dogs at the Briggs Animal Adoption Center website, www.baacs.org. That's baacs.org. You'll be doing something very nice for the pet you adopt, and it doesn't take long for you to discover how much these pets will help you and add to your quality of life. The Briggs Animal Adoption Center is an affiliate of the National Humane Education Society. For more information, call 304-724-6558 or visit their website, www.baacs.org.
Magellan! No. Well, who knows what Magellan did?
Sail around the world!
Right! Now.
Sometimes, a child who doesn't seem interested is really a child with a speech or hearing problem.
Blackbeard! Who said Blackbeard? And what did Blackbeard do? He was a
pirate.
Time and again, it's been shown that a young student's ability to read and learn begins with speech and language and hearing skills.
Jamie, are you with us? Who can tell us?
He wanted to go to India.
Many communication disorders can be detected early and corrected, so learning and literacy skills can develop normally. Make sure your child has the speech, language, and hearing abilities to keep up in class. For more information, visit ASHA.org, a public service message from the American Speech Language Hearing Association and this station.
For a new route to
Asia!
Good.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. We're all learning a lot today about some countries that, not too many people know about. They end in S-T-A-N or Stan, and I'm not talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan, probably the two countries most familiar to Americans. I'm talking about five countries in Central Asia that are all primarily Islamic countries. They're all former territories of the Soviet Union. They're all more or less dictatorships. There's one possible counterexample, which we'll get to in a minute. But some have oil deposits, some have U.S. military bases, some are helping us against terrorism, and some, you could argue, particularly Uzbekistan, which I'm going to get to in a second, you could argue we're actually supporting dictatorship. But my guest is Chad Clay. He is a director of the USAID Enterprise Development Project for Central Asia, and he's the expert in all these countries. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. Chad, you were telling me before the break a little bit about what USAID does in all of these countries. Can you fill us in?
Okay. Basically, all the U.S. aid that is given to other countries goes through USAID.
Well, does that include military aid, or are you just talking about economic
aid? No, I'm talking about economic development
aid.
All
right.
So, basically, there's a lot of different projects that the USAID is involved in, everything from democracy projects to environmental projects and then economic development projects. And I focused on the economic development area, but there's a wide range of projects that USAID is involved in trying to help these countries and, more importantly, probably the citizens of these countries to improve their lives.
What is economic development? Helping people with small businesses? What
it can be a wide range of things. It can be macro projects such as working with the banking community or banking reforms. USAID helped Kazakhstan set up a stock exchange, a banking system, a national banking system.
Now, how does what USAID does differ, or is it similar to what the Soros Foundation does, George Soros?
Well, Soros Foundation does a lot of similar type projects more on the micro level. His biggest impact, I think, in these areas has been in education. He set up several universities around the area, Kyrgyz American University, for example, in Bishkek, was a Soros Foundation project.
Okay, I want to move to another country in Central Asia. This is a country that's the most populous, which is surprising if you look at it on a map because it's much smaller than a huge country like Kazakhstan. It's a country called Uzbekistan. It's a country that Chad has already pointed out has a long, distinguished history of settled people long before the Soviet Union came. And it's a country that's most in the news these days because of a serious crackdown on an independence movement that has, I don't know whether it's just starting or not. I'm going to ask Chad on that in a minute. But the crackdown is so severe that they've been killing people. People, just a few, escaped across the border. We still don't know how many civilians were killed just in the last few days. Tell us, Chad, what is going on in Uzbekistan?
Well, Uzbekistan is probably the politically the worst of the five Central Asian countries. The leader there, Karimov, is pretty ruthless. The human rights violations there are pretty severe. There's a lot of disappearances by people who appear to be or may actually be involved in some sort of political opposition. Any sort of significant display of religious activity is looked on very suspiciously by the government. And that country is probably the biggest problem on the horizon as far as dealing with this part of the world from an international relations standpoint.
Well, let's take it step by step. First of all, I understand that torture is systematic in Uzbekistan. It's not happening on occasion. It's pretty common over there.
I think that's safe to say. I mean, relative to most countries in the world, yeah.
And yet the United States, I read in the Washington Post today, is doing a little bit of rendition over there. We are sending suspected terrorists to Uzbekistan to be questioned. And to this government that you just described as a government that regularly does torture. Is this something which is causing some controversy in the U.S. government, or is it just, well, they're terrorists, if they're tortured, that's tough?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's debate behind the scenes in the government about how to deal with this country. They have been a big, quote-unquote, ally in the world war on terror.
We have a military base there.
We do have a military base there, and of course there have been stories in the news about the CIA getting involved in sending some of the prisoners of war, so to speak, over there for questioning, and that probably involves some tactics that are less than
Well, tell me this. What is actually going on? The last week, these countries never get in the news, and yet Uzbekistan has been in the news the past 3-4 days. What exactly is going on over there?
Well, from what I can gather, and I'm in the U.S. now, and I'm actually no longer on the project with USAID. So I was in Uzbekistan in February, but I'm not, you know, I can only speak now about what I'm sort of hearing in the news. But what it sounds like is there was some sort of display or protest in Andijan, which is a smaller city, not the capital city, but a smaller city in the Fergana Valley. And apparently what happened was, you know, the government mobilized, and in the way that it probably typically reacts to any sort of display such as this, did so violently. And I think the official estimates coming out of from the Uzbek government is about 160 people were killed. I think realistically I've heard that it's probably 3 or 4 times that.
Yeah,
so what you had is a demonstration of some sort. I'm based on what I know of the area and the people, it probably was peaceful. It was probably pretty quiet, and the government, you know, overreacted and shot into the crowd and probably killed upwards to about 500 people.
My question, as always, has to do with U.S. politics and U.S. policy, and I want to read to you from the article in the Washington Post on Uzbekistan today, mm-hmm. and ask you to comment on it.
Okay.
It said, last summer, then-Secretary of State Colin Powell refused to certify that Uzbekistan had improved its human rights record, cutting off 18 million in military training. But weeks later, Air Force General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, visited Tashkent, the capital, and criticized that decision by Colin Powell to cut off aid as very short-sighted. He announced the U.S. would be giving $21 million, or more money, for bioterrorism defense, and the State Department later restored $7 million of the suspended aid, arguing it was for priorities such as health care and nuclear security. This is a direct quote from the Washington Post. The result, according to critics, is that Uzbek officials shrug off U.S. complaints about repression. They don't take the State Department seriously, said Tom Malinowski of Human Rights Watch. They think the Pentagon and CIA will protect them, so the Uzbeks are not inclined to listen to American diplomats when they get lectured on democracy, unquote. I want you to comment on that. Do you think that's true, Chad?
Well, it's definitely a touchy situation. I mean, in a lot of ways, we want to be involved in what's going on in Uzbekistan, because if we pull out completely, or, you know, shun the government for its activities or whatever, which is in a lot of cases, I think what we could or should be doing, then you have absolutely no say in what's going on in the country. So it's a difficult and a touchy situation. That, you know, in a lot of ways these governments are sort of like spoiled children, and you're giving them sort of a carrot and hoping that they act in a certain way, and then when they turn around and do something naughty, you know, you can take away the carrot, and then you've got nothing to hold over them anymore. So I can see why Colin Powell spoke the way he did. I think he's absolutely right. From the military standpoint, it gets a little bit touchy regarding how involved or how much of a relationship we want to have with a government of this kind. And the scary outcome could be, you know, if this thing does turn into a revolution, or if this leader is overthrown and an Islamic-friendly government were to replace it, you know, we could be sitting on the same situation we were with Iran, you know, a long time ago, and we found ourselves on the wrong side of a dictator that, you know, kind of mistreats its people.
I was just going to say, Chad, I know you're familiar with history, as am I, and it seems to me that this is a pattern that is constantly repeating itself. We support the Shah of Iran, ruthless dictator, tortures his people, said to be friendly to America. He's overthrown by government more hostile to us. We supported Saddam Hussein until he turned against us. We supported the dictator of Panama. We supported in Afghanistan the Mujahideen fighting against the Soviet Union. Some of our aid reached al-Qaeda. It seems that time and time again, Latin America, I can't begin to name the countries, Chile and Argentina and El Salvador, where we are supporting dictatorships who ruthlessly treat their people And then the dictator is overthrown, and lo and behold, to no one's surprise, these countries are anti-American. Now, I don't know how much you can comment on this stuff politically, but don't you think that this kind of activity in the long run is counterproductive?
Well, yeah, I think it can be, depending on the way the future turns out. And I think that the thinking is, and this is certainly true in this part of the world, is sometimes the known enemy or the known evil is sometimes better than the unknown. And so I think the reason we walk so gingerly through this part of the world is because you just don't know what's around the corner. And if you throw all your chips into, you know, one side or the other, if you come out the loser, you're sort of standing there with absolutely no political connections or relationships in the area. So while, you know, that's why we're sort of talking out of two sides of our mouth here. I think you've seen some State Department reactions to the recent Uzbek events that, you know, sound very harsh, yet are we going to pull out and abandon aid completely? Probably not.
Well, according to at least Tom Malinowski, they quote, the Uzbeks are not inclined to listen to American diplomats when they get lectured on democracy. They don't take the State Department seriously. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you're giving them aid with one hand and wagging your finger with another, we've seen that with Saudi Arabia and other countries. They can basically just ignore us. We have to take another commercial break. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. What do all recent U.S. wars have in common against Afghanistan, against Saddam Hussein, against Noriega and Panama? What do all they all have in common? These are all people that our government once supported. I want you to think about that while we go to a commercial break. If you want to comment on the blog, it's radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after this.
If you've been thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to four real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and I get turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? Ha, ha, ha. She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from around the world that the government does not want you to know about and that the media isn't reporting much. We've just been talking about Uzbekistan. This is probably the worst country of all. It's a country where they do systematic torture, where we send people to be tortured. Yet we have a U.S. military base there, and our government continues to support them. How does this interact with the theory of the Bush Doctrine that supposedly we helped to promote democracy all over the world? Why are we talking about the Stans of Central Asia today? Because, well, let me ask you this. Did you know where Iraq was before the Persian Gulf War? Did you know where Afghanistan was, what was going on there before the Soviet invasion, before September 11th? It's important to know about these things before they become flashpoints, and that's why I've invited my guest today, a true expert in all these five Central Asian countries. His name is Chad Clay. He's the former director of the USAID Enterprise Development Project for Central Asia. I'd like to move on to our other countries, if I could, Chad. Maybe one of the – we've talked about the worst, perhaps, Uzbekistan. This is the country – I want to move to Kyrgyzstan, a country that seems to provide the most hope, if you will. Is it fair to say Kyrgyzstan is the least dictatorship-like country, the most democratic?
At the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was sort of the political darling in the region from the U.S.'s standpoint. Oskar Akayev, who was the president at the time, initially out of the gate, was definitely showing some very democratic tendencies. He seemed to be moving the country very quickly towards Western style of rule. He was freeing up the economy to sort of operate on its own, which is, of course, you know, the way the U.S. government likes to see it. And I fully support that.
Has it changed?
It has changed. He sort of made a turn for the worse about 5 years ago and sort of began, you know, the typical – I think he was always – sort of funneling some money into his own accounts, but he seemed to be clamping down a lot more on some of that stuff. And he, you know, at probably the point of his departure a few months ago was probably just as bad as the rest of the gang, really. And again, you know, not like Uzbekistan, which I think from a human rights perspective is the worst, but he was definitely not moving the country towards democracy as quickly as he had at one point. The Kyrgyzstan is actually the only Central Asian country that is in the WTO, and I think he was let in.
The World Trade Organization.
Yeah. Kyrgyzstan was sort of let into that group, sort of, I think, a little prematurely based on a lot of promises that he was making towards the, you know, the economic liberalization of the country and things like that.
But they have a new leader now, Chad?
They do have a new leader. He was in February there were parliamentary elections.
Free elections?
Parliamentary elections.
Were they free?
He was not up for election.
My question is, were they free and fair elections?
Well, they weren't. And
okay.
That was what actually led to his demise, so to speak. The elections were seen as largely corrupt. There were a lot of obvious non-democratic things going on. The OSCE, which monitored the election with the help of USAID, sort of denounced the elections as unfair, not transparent. And what happened was there was protests began to spawn protests in the southern part of the country, and then the capital city. There was a march on the Capitol, and the march sort of, they walked right into the White House, and he fled, and now there's a new leader in charge.
Well, now, under the old leader, we had a U.S. base, right?
Yes.
And they have significant oil. We had U.S. oil interests there, right?
They do not have oil.
Oh, they do not have oil.
No,
they're
sort of they're lacking in that gift from God.
So okay, sure. But they had a U.S. base that we were using
there.
And since the U.S. base was established under the former leader who as we talked about, went downhill. Does that mean that the new government of Kyrgyzstan is less friendly to the United States?
I don't think so. I think the base will remain. I don't think there'll be a lot of changes externally regarding international relations. I hope there are some changes internally. The country is economically not very well off right now. There are obviously democracy needs some work. There's going to be the interim leader has actually declared that there will be a presidential election in July. So he's willing to put himself on the ballot and hopefully open it up fairly to others that want to run for president. So,
and it is the freest country today of the five.
The freest, the best
human rights.
I'd say that in Kazakhstan.
Okay. Let me move on to Turkmenistan, and then, folks, when we're done with each of the countries, I want to talk generally about their geopolitical role and U.S. policy. But let's quickly go on to Turkmenistan, which I understand does have very large oil deposits and is actually a fairly closed one-party state. What can you tell us about Turkmenistan?
Turkmenistan is the traditional no-argument dictatorship. The guy... Niyazov is the president, but he's mostly referred to as Turkmenbashi, which means father of the Turkmen people. And he's sort of, I mean, a lot of people claim he's kind of insane, and certainly his actions sort of would go along with that. He's renamed days of the week for members of his family.
Yeah, sounds like Kim Jong-il, kind of.
He's up there. He's not, now, he is a dictator, and he's definitely does some strange things, but actually the Turkmen people don't have it too badly.
Is that because of the oil or other reasons?
Yeah, they've got some money. A lot of things are still state-run. You can take a Turkmen citizen can take a flight from one end of the country to the other for about $7. So things are price-controlled. The state provides everything to the people, water.
Now, who are they selling their oil to? The United States or other countries?
They're putting it on the international market. I don't know exactly. I don't know what percent is purchased by which countries, but I believe the U.S. ends up with some of that. I think natural gas is actually where the most of their energy.
And according to the BBC website, the Turkmen president actually promised elections in 2009. Is there any reason to believe that these will actually be fair, or is that just an empty promise?
I can't imagine that'll happen. He at that point, he will be constitutionally ineligible to run. Now, that's constitutionally. But in the same breath, the legislation has declared unanimously or begged him, quote-unquote, to be ruler for life.
Yeah.
So I don't think there'll be any election. He actually won the last election, quote-unquote, with 99-point-something percent of the vote. And I don't think he's going anywhere until he dies.
And what's the U.S. relationship with Turkmenistan?
There almost is none. We do have an embassy there. It's very small. USAID does have operations there. I actually know the head of the USAID operations there, and there's just very limited amount of activity going on.
Okay, Chad, I want to move on because we don't have too much time. I want to move on, talk about Tajikistan, take a quick break, and then overall talk about the importance of these five Central Asian nations. We have one left. It is Tajikistan, and this is the only country, I think, that's had a civil war.
Yep.
Tell us about the history of Tajikistan.
Well, at the collapse, it did have a civil war. It got sort of the quote-unquote dictator there. They are the poorest of the five countries. They've got 60% of the population pretty much lives in poverty, 40% unemployment. They've got it's a very mountainous country. As a result, it's very porous from a security standpoint. A lot of the heroin that you hear so much about in Afghanistan, northern Afghanistan, goes through Tajikistan on its way to Europe and Russia. So they've got a lot of security concerns, certainly from a Islamic fundamentalism standpoint.
Are, Are they the country that would be the biggest supporter or aid to Islamic terrorists?
They don't. Well, the government cracks down, would crack down certainly, but
Al-Qaeda has bases there and things like that.
What's that?
Al-Qaeda has a lot of people there.
There's probably some sort of Al-Qaeda. There's some cells probably in the mountainous areas and things like that. Actually, the border is maintained, believe it or not, still by the Russian army. The Russians still control the border between Afghanistan and Tajikistan.
Are they doing a decent job in keeping out terrorists or not?
I think they probably are in that way, but I think they probably are very liberal with the drug trafficking. I'm sure they turn a blind eye for you know, their own benefit.
Okay. We've been through the individual trees, if you will, each of the five countries of Central Asia. I got to take another break. When we come back, though, I want to talk in general about all of these countries, about what it matters geopolitically, why we should care about these five countries. What does it mean for oil, for Islamic fundamentalism, for United States support of either dictatorships or democracy? These are broad questions, but my guest, I think, will be very good handling that. If you want to call in, you're welcome to do so. I realize it's a topic that is unfamiliar to many of you, including me. I just, in fact, learned a lot for this broadcast. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. Or you can comment on the blog at radioinsidescoop.com. We'll be right back after these messages.
Heart disease, but did you know that it's the number one killer of women nationwide? Some of these women may have it and not even know it. Heart disease claims more lives each year than breast cancer, lung cancer, or strokes combined, but there are steps you can take to protect yourself against it. While not smoking, daily exercise, and a nutritious diet are good for your health, they're critical in the fight against heart disease. Most important, get regular checkups and ask your doctor about risk factors, especially if you're over 40, when the risk of heart disease increases dramatically. For more information on how you can prevent heart disease, contact your local American Heart Association or visit their website at www.americanheart.org. It's never too late to protect your heart health. Start now.
If you're looking for a great deal, look no further than the CX 4600 All-in-One from Epson. No one else gives you so many great features at such a brilliant price, like individual cartridges of DuraBrite ink for water, smudge, and fade-resistant photos, and built-in card slots to print directly from memory cards. You can also restore your old photos to their original beauty, all for around $99 after a $30 mail-in rebate. Buy now and also get a $20 reward card back by mail. For more brilliant deals, visit Epson.com/promotions.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. Today we've had a bit of a geography lesson. We're learning about countries that maybe don't pose the biggest problem to U.S. security now, but they may very well in the future. My guest is Chad Clay, and we're talking about the STANs, the five countries of Central Asia, the former Soviet countries. Chad Clay worked for 2.5 years in Kazakhstan with the USAID Enterprise Development Project. We've been going over the history of these countries, and I'd like to step back a little and examine why these countries matter, why they're important. And I'd like to read to you, Chad, a comment I have on the blog from Skip. Skip writes, Mark, be sure to have your guests talk about all the military bases in the STANs. Are we there for humanitarian reasons? Are we there to replace a nasty dictatorship with democracy? I don't think so. If you could respond to Skip's comment and tell us where we do have military bases. You mentioned Uzbekistan. Where else do we have them?
The other one in Central Asia is in Kyrgyzstan.
In Kyrgyzstan. So how would you respond to Skip's comment? Are we there for humanitarian reasons? Are we there to replace a nasty dictatorship with democracy, or are we there just to get a military base?
Well, we being the military, certainly we're not there for humanitarian reasons. The reason for the influx of U.S. military presence there was directly as a result of 9/11, the proximity to Afghanistan, and a lot of the air war that's gone on continuously in Afghanistan.
and our biggest air base, I believe, is in Uzbekistan, which is the worst, as you said, humanitarian country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. We do. I mean, and we have relations with a country that is sort of counter to a lot of the beliefs that spreading democracy and things like that. So.
Now, we supported the Iran against the Soviet Union, the Shah, that dictator. That fell apart, and the Iranians hated us. And then we supported Saddam Hussein against Iran, and that fell apart. Saddam Hussein turned against us, and we had to take him down. What's the future of a country like Uzbekistan? I mean, are we going to have to turn around and fight our former allies?
Well, that's the concern. There's an interesting speech given by Craig Murray, who was the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan. And in that, he talks about his love of the Uzbek people and his love for the country, and then sort of the British and the American roles regarding that country. And, his concern, I think a concern that is a legitimate one, is when you give the Uzbek people no alternative to a dictator, and that dictator is supported, sort of outwardly by the United States and the British, and the reasons for that make some sense in some cases. When there is an overthrow, and I think it's a matter of when, not if.
So you think it's going to happen in Uzbekistan?
I think that will happen. I think he may rule longer than a few years or something like that. But
three, 5 years, it's going to
be overthrown. Eventually he's going to go. I mean, if he can't rule forever, and at some point there's going to be a change. And if things continue the way they are, the change will be radical. Because.
And what do the Uzbek people think of the United States?
Well, I mean, I was in Uzbekistan, and I was there actually with my wife's family as a tourist last summer, and I've been there for work several times over the last 2.5 years. And the people are wonderful, and they're outwardly very open and welcoming toward Americans. They were extremely friendly. They brought us into a mosque. They gave us gifts, and they generally like Americans. I mean, they see the Americans as free, and they want the same things that Americans have. Now politically, I don't, if they oppose the government, and a lot of them do, and they know that we are actively supporting the government, then obviously they aren't going to make that. They're going to connect the dots.
Well, Chad, let me ask you this. You mentioned when we were talking about the history in the early part of this broadcast, you mentioned that since these countries were taken over by the Soviet Union, which we talked about was an atheist government, that their Islamist notions, they knew they were Muslim, but they didn't have strong Islamic tendencies, certainly not strong Islamic fundamentalist tendencies. Does the fact that they have repressive governments today, and I'm not talking now just about Uzbekistan, but about all five of them, does that make Islamic movements to overthrow these governments, are they growing? Do we have to worry about future Islamic terrorists coming from the stands?
I don't think we have to worry about it directly. I don't think the next, if there is one, attack against America coming from the Islamic world will originate in Uzbekistan. But I do think there is an underground movement that is gaining support and not so much because anyone is pro-Islamic State, but they're anti-Karimov. And if your enemy, your enemy's enemy, sort of your friend, if you know that the guy in charge is not doing a good job and is tortured or beat up your brother or his government has or something like that, and the Islamic movement comes along and says, "Hey, do you want to join us?" It's tempting, and I think.
Well, are they helping? I mean, is Al Qaeda and other Islamic movements, terrorist movements, are they helping the people overthrow their dictatorship leaders?
Well, I think they're there. I think they're, the movement, the demonstration that was, broken up this week was originated by a group that was supporting an Islamic, that Uzbekistan become an Islamic state. So
these are likely allies in the future. Let me ask you, we only got a couple minutes left, and I always try to end on a more positive note. Chad, what do you think we should be doing? If you were president of the United States, if you were in control of U.S. policy toward these countries, what do we do in a country like Uzbekistan that so mistreats its people but is willing to give us a military base? What should U.S. policy be?
Well, I think this we're afforded a kind of an opportunity right now as a result of the recent events. I think we can, and I think we should, come out in a more, a stronger stance regarding democratic reform, human rights reform, and things like that. I think, we can really use this opportunity to sort of point out that this is not in conjunction with, U.S. beliefs, so to speak, and take a more critical stance against what's going on in the country. And we do have an opportunity to sort of press the issue right now, especially in light of these human rights violations.
I'm afraid our time is up, Chad. I happen to agree with you. I think that in general, if we take the stand of human rights, then people will eventually find us and help us. And when we support dictators, my personal belief is it always comes back to bite us. And we're seen as someone who promotes dictatorship rather than democracy around the world. The Bush Doctrine is supposedly about promoting democracy, but again and again and again, our government is seen supporting these dictators. I think Chad Clay is right. Uzbekistan would be a perfect opportunity for us to turn this around and finally be on the right side of history. Chad Clay, thank you very much for coming here on the Inside Scoop. I appreciate that. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about the story in Newsweek. Many people have talked about it. Did they make a mistake when they said that U.S. troops were flushing Qurans down the toilet? And why is it that the administration has picked up on this particular error and made such a big deal out of it? That's tomorrow's Inside Scoop, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. This is Mark Levine signing off.